Thank you, Kathy. Shalom, Havarim. Hello, friends. All right, we are ready this morning. You know, we've had some success recently with our Bible quiz team, right? This is not news to you. You've heard this before. We did well last week, and by well, I mean finishing first. So, well done, Bible quiz team. I thought it'd be interesting to start this morning with a little bit of Bible quizzing for you all as well. So, I've got a few questions for you. And I'm going to do that in the format of a Bible quiz. If you know the answer, I'm not going to make you stand up, but call it out. Question. What is the only U.S. state that is named in the Bible? The only U.S. state named in the Bible. Nothing? Nobody? No? Okay. The only U.S. state named in the Bible is Arkansas. Noah looked out his ark and saw all of the rain. No? Okay. I've got one more. I know you didn't get that one. We're going to try another one. If you have the answer, feel free to call it out. Question. Who was the fastest person in the Bible? Who was the fastest person in the Bible? It was, of course, Adam. Adam was the first person in the human race. Oh, my. Tough group this morning. All right. That's true. He started first. I don't know if he finished first. Anyway, we are here. That's all I have for you right now. But we are here in the fifth Sunday of our sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount. And I realized this week that I have been preaching for 5 weeks on a sermon that took Jesus probably 20 minutes to preach. I have probably got, actually I know I have over 2 hours of commentary on this 20-minute sermon. I'm going to add another half an hour worth today, and we only made it through the first chapter. And I say that because I just want to emphasize how important the Sermon on the Mount is, especially in the Mennonite Church. Today we're going to be looking at something that is central to our identity as Mennonites, central to our understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. We're going to be talking about things like loving our enemies. We're going to be talking about things like turning the other cheek and going the extra mile and trying to understand just what Jesus could have meant when he said these things. This is not easy teaching. It is engaging teaching. It's compelling teaching, but it's not necessarily simple. So we're going to try to understand a little bit better what Jesus could have meant when he said these things. So I am looking at today the antitheses numbers 5 through 6. This is my creative way of naming my sermon today. Last week we had antitheses 1 through 4. Today, antitheses 5 through 6. I need to remind you a little bit what we've been doing. We kind of had some established rules, not rules, but guidelines as we have looked at these passages. So I looked at, a couple of weeks ago, the passage where Jesus says, "Do not believe that I've come here to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come here to fulfill them." And then in that same passage, he talked about how we are called to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And we looked at some different opportunities, different ways to read those words from Jesus. And this is kind of what I came up with. And nobody disagreed with me, so I assume you're all on the same page. still room for flexibility and interpretation. But my understanding of this, when Jesus says these things, is what he's doing is he's trying to get to the source of our problems. He's trying to get to the root. He's not addressing just the symptoms. He's getting to the problem itself. So he's saying, yes, it's bad to murder people, but what is the root of murder? Well, anger is the root. If we can rid ourselves of anger, we don't need to worry so much about the murder. And then I looked at all these different ways to read these passages and how people have interpreted Jesus as using, you know, some sort of humorous kind of way to get people's attention. You know, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. Ha, 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 Jesus, that's a good one. We talked about how Jesus could be understood as speaking to a small group and not like the entire church. But what I want to show is I think that Jesus really expects this of us. Like, yeah, there's grace for when we fail because we're going to fail. But he actually wants us to try to do these things. So keep those two things in mind today as we look at these last two antitheses from Jesus. I think Jesus is trying to get to the source of the problem, And I think that, yeah, Jesus really wants us to try to do it. Can you keep that in mind? All right. All right. Enthusiastic. Yes, I like it. Okay, so in today's passage from Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 38, Jesus throws out this passage that we've probably all heard before. And when I say throw it out, I mean he like speaks it. He doesn't like throw it out. He's not doing that. He speaks this passage. We've heard it before. It's a common phrase. He says, "You have heard it said before, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Is this new to anybody? No, this is something that we call the lex talionis. I know you want to speak some Latin today. Say with me, lex talionis. Lex talionis is the law of equal retribution. Equal retribution. So that means that if somebody harms you, you can only harm them equally in return. So if you come up to me and you scratch out my eye, I can only come up to you and scratch out one of your eyes. It's the law. Marlene, I can do it. She's looking at me. She's a little nervous. If you don't scratch out my eye, you don't have to worry about it. Or if you come out and you knock out one of my teeth, guess what I get to do? I get to come and knock out one of your teeth. It's in the law. I'm allowed to do it, right? It's found three different times in the Old Testament in its clearest teachings. We find it in Exodus 21:24, Leviticus 24:20, and Deuteronomy 19:21. So very clearly, it limits the retribution that you can bring or do whenever somebody causes harm. Now, I know that sounded really, I don't know, rough. Like, it sounded like who would do that? Like, who would scratch out someone's eye if they took out your eye? Well, let's read it in context even yet. It gets even kind of worse. In Exodus 21, "But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." Yeah, okay. So it sounds really almost barbaric, right? I would even take out that almost. It sounds barbaric. If somebody comes up and injures you, you're allowed to go and injure them. And can you imagine a world where you can walk around and it's like, oh, there's a bruise. You know, now I got to give you one back. You know, that seems just like barbaric to me. But in Jesus' day, they would have understood the lex talionis as progress. This would have been progress in the name of justice, equal retribution. If someone injured you, you couldn't go and do worse to them. And I often come back to the passage from Genesis chapter 4, verses 23 through 24. There's this guy named Lamech, and he's bragging about his power. He's actually doing this bragging to his wife. And actually his wives. He says, "I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. So he's kind of taking this injury that he has received, and he's saying, well, I'm going to get you back even worse. And he's like, yeah, there's this concept about Cain being avenged 7 times. Well, Lamech, if he's injured, he's going to go out and he's going to injure somebody else 77 times. This is the concept that we see in much of our world today. If somebody does you wrong, if somebody messes with your turf or your power or whatever it is, you get to go back and you do it worse to them. If you don't do it worse to them, it's seen as weak. Like you're someone that can walk all over. So you got to get them back worse than they got you. So the idea here with the lex talionis is that it's equal retribution. If somebody harms you, you can't get them back 77 times. You can only retribute equal pain or suffering, whatever. That sounds so terrible. You can only give them equal pain and suffering in return. Now, I often like to draw people's attention to Matthew chapter 18 at this point. In Matthew 18, there's this story of Peter, and he's talking to Jesus. And you know Peter. Peter kind of shoots off at the mouth sometimes. Peter's kind of feeling good about himself. He goes up to Jesus. He says, "Jesus, tell me, if somebody sins against me, how many times do I have to forgive them?" And he offers him a number. He says, "Should I forgive them as much as, I don't know, 7 times? Like Peter's feeling good about himself. He's expecting Jesus to say good things like, "Oh, Peter, you're so gracious and so kind." And Jesus says, "No, not 7 times, but..." Well, wait a second, what's it say? Some translations, you'll look in your Bible, you'll find a footnote Some translations, Jesus says 70 times 7. Now, 70 times 7 is a big number. I had to get out my calculator and I figured that up. That's 490 times. So Jesus is essentially saying you have to forgive somebody almost like without end. But if you look at the footnote, you notice that the Greek is not clear. And Greek numbers can be a little bit challenging. Greek language can be challenging. That's why they say it's all Greek to me. But Jesus says in the footnote 77 times. And I like that translation better, even though 77 is a lot smaller than 490, because he's saying, unlike Lamech, you need to forgive almost ad infinitum, like without reservation, you continue to forgive. But I'm getting off the point here now. All right, so here we have this story about this lex talionis, and this is the limitation of retribution. And Jesus comes in and he starts talking about, hey, if somebody wrongs you, you have to really be kind to them. There is no retaliation. He's like, no, if somebody slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other. If somebody tries to take your coat from them, give them your shirt as well. If somebody tries to make you carry their pack 1 mile, you go ahead and do that for 2 miles. Now, it seems like Jesus is moving this whole like spectrum a little bit. At one point, we had Lamech who was saying things like, I'm going to like get 70 times 7 return for whatever issues there were here, or 77 times retribution. And now there's a lex talionis that limits that. And all at once, Jesus is saying, well, just let people walk all over you. But that's not what's going on here. Jesus isn't encouraging people to let people walk all over them. He's actually calling them to a new way of thinking. And sometimes they refer to this as the transforming initiatives. Jesus is challenging the people to think differently about the problems in their world. And I've talked about these transforming initiatives a number of times. I don't want to go through each of them. Even though the kids like to pretend to slap the pastor. We talked about this a couple months ago when I looked at the martyrs. But I will highlight one of those stories here for you yet this morning. There is this passage in this chapter about carrying somebody's pack 1 mile. Or I think quite literally it just says, if somebody makes you go 1 mile, go with them too. All right, who could make you go a mile? Have you ever thought about that? Maybe your parent could make you go a mile. Like, I need to go to get groceries. You're coming with me. Your parent could make you go a mile. When you are a grown man, like myself, you know, I like to think of myself as a grown man. This wasn't a joke. A grown man or a grown woman, a grown person, who could make you go a mile? Well, probably nobody could just force you to go a mile today. But back in Jesus' day, there was a law in place that a Roman soldier could make a citizen carry their pack 1 mile. And their pack was full of things like armor and weapons. And those things are heavy. Thank you. Those things are heavy. And they could make you carry them 1 mile, but there was a law that said they couldn't make you carry them any more than a mile. So Jesus is saying, if a person makes you go with them a mile, if they make you carry their pack for this 1 mile, carry it a second mile as well. Well, what happens if you carry that pack a second mile? Two things I thought of. One, you are performing an act of love or charity for someone you consider an enemy. We're going to talk about that a little bit more here in a few minutes. But you're loving this person who you would consider to be your enemy. Remember, the Romans were occupying the city at the time. They were policing this town. But you are doing this act of love, this act of charity for somebody that you don't even want to be there. Additionally, it exposes the unjust law that permits forced manual labor. So I imagine that I'm carrying a pack for a Roman soldier, and I do what is legally, like what I'm legally bound to do. I carry this pack 1 mile, and then I just keep on going. And you imagine the Romans like, whoa, hey, you know, buddy, like set that down. Like, yeah, that's the law. That's all further. You can go. They're like, no, I'm going to keep going. Let's go another mile. No, man, people are watching. Like, you can't be doing this, because this would be bad for the Roman. They would see him breaking the law. And all at once, it kind of exposes this. And you say to this Roman soldier, well, if it's okay for you to make me walk 1 mile with your pack, why is it not okay for me to go 2? You see that none of this was just. None of this was right in the first place. So Jesus isn't saying just to let people walk all over you. He's saying we need to expose the injustices around us. He's calling people to act creatively to expose this injustice. All right, let's go on to verses 43 through 44. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Let's pause there just a second. That first part, love your neighbor, that is in the Torah. And I just want to make sure it's clear that hate your enemy part, that's not actually in the Hebrew Bible anywhere. That was probably something that they just kind of said. You've heard it before. He's not saying where it was from. Just to be clear, that's not in the Bible. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We are just coming off of one of the hallmark holidays of our calendar year. Anybody celebrate Valentine's Day recently? Sarah Dell is the only one. All right. Let me give you a little tip. If you hurry after church and you go to your local grocery store or your local drugstore, something like that, you can get candy marked down 50% yet. If you hurry, you have to beat me there. The flowers are cheaper as well. You can still get a really good deal, and you can get some candy, you can get some flowers, and you can take them to your enemy tomorrow. Wouldn't that be lovely? I did not say that. I'm going to kindly move on. You can take these things to your wife. Is that what Jesus is saying? Take flowers and candy to your enemies, you know, love them like you would. No. Now remember, there's different words for love that are used in the New Testament. Remember, Greek is very challenging. And I looked it up, and what word do you think Jesus is using here? He's using the word agape. This is the word that we find in John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he sent his one and only Son. This is the same word that Jesus uses when he talks about laying his life down for people, even when they were still his enemies. This is the self-giving, the sacrificial kind of love. Jesus is calling us to love our enemies in that way, in the very way that Jesus loved us. We're called to do that. And then he goes on and says this thing about praying for those who persecute you. Now, I'm wondering, have any of you ever heard of the imprecatory prayers? Yeah, another fancy word. Drop that one around the water cooler tomorrow. People will be, oh, that's interesting. Imprecatory prayers. Imprecatory simply means to wish ill upon a person. So it's good that you don't know what an imprecatory prayer is. Now you know. There are actually a number of psalms in the Bible that we consider imprecatory psalms. The best known is Psalm 109. Psalm 109, verses 8 through 9, says this: may his days be few. May another take his place of leadership. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. And all God's people said, eh? So this is an imprecatory prayer that we find in the book of Psalms. And you have seen people, maybe you haven't seen it, but I've seen people that have taken the Psalms, Psalm 109 especially, and applied that to political leaders of our day. There was a famous billboard that was put up, I don't even remember where it was, where someone put an advertisement to encourage people to pray for President Obama. And it said Psalm 109, so it looked kind of like this. Pray for Obama, Psalm 109, verse 8. May his days be short, may someone take his position of leadership. And just to make sure to not be outdone, people follow that up then with bumper stickers. Pray for Trump, Psalm 109, verse 8. Is this what Jesus is talking about when he says, pray for those who persecute you? Pray imprecatory prayers upon them? That is a lot of puzz, isn't it? That's why the seats in the front are always open. No, this is not what Jesus is suggesting. Like, this is kind of funny. It's kind of cute until you actually read the whole context. It's like, yeah, really? That's not good. It's kind of funny, but it's not Jesus-y, is it? It's not Christ-like. I think that when Jesus said to love your enemies, I think that when Jesus said to pray for those who persecute you, he actually meant it. Now, let me ask you this question. And if I step on any toes at first, please know I'm going to try to step on toes equally. I like to think of myself as an equal opportunity offender, something like that. But when we think about the Mennonite church, and I said that this is central to our understanding of the Mennonite church, central to who we are those who love our enemies and forgive the people who have hurt us. But when we think about that kind of teaching, that peace and justice kind of position of the Mennonite church, what side of politics do you tend to associate peace and justice issues with? What is your image of a peace and justice kind of person, a peace and justice kind of pastor, a peace and justice kind of congregation? Well, when I think of P&J, shorten it up, P&J pastors and congregations and churches, I tend to think of a bunch of liberal hippies. As a picture of, no, that's not me. you think of the guy with the long hair, and he's got the facial hair, sometimes this long beard. They're throwing up the deuces. They've got the peace sign. They're wearing the tie-dye. Maybe they drove a Vanagon at some point. Did you see that Volkswagen is making an all-electric one now? Yeah, pretty slick. They probably drive electric vehicles or Priuses or something like that. Bunch of hippies. These are the kind of people that I think of as working for peace and justice. These are liberal people. They tend to vote liberal. They tend to vote for the Democratic Party. They tend to drive electric cars. And I'm gesturing towards somebody, and they tend to drive electric cars. This is the kind of people that tend to work for peace and justice. But when we think about liberal theology is a category of a certain kind of way of doing theology. And when I think of liberal theology, I think of people like Rudolf Bultmann. Rudolf Bultmann was known for what he called demythologizing Christianity. So Bultmann said that the Gospels could not be used as authentic sources for understanding Jesus. The only way to really understand Jesus was through your own experiences. When I think about liberal theology, I think of a group called the Jesus Seminar. And the Jesus Seminar, I'm not sure if they're still active or not, but it used to be the case that this group of New Testament scholars would get together about twice a year, and they would sit down in this room and they'd study different passages from the Gospels, and they would vote on whether Jesus actually said something or not. If it was highly likely, they gave it a certain coloring. If it was unlikely, they gave it a different color, and then there were different spots in the middle along that spectrum. Then you're probably familiar, if you grew up around here or you've lived in Virginia for a while, you maybe know of the Jefferson Bible. Thomas Jefferson took his Bible and he read through it and he started cutting out. He took his X-Acto knife and removed parts that he didn't agree with, parts that didn't line up with his way of thinking, things that didn't make sense to him, things like miracles. If it didn't line up with his progressive kind of way of thought, his modernist way of thinking, he removed it from his Bible. Now, this is kind of how we traditionally have thought of liberal theology. Liberal theology says if it doesn't really make sense to us, it probably didn't happen. We don't actually have to engage these things. We don't actually have to take it seriously. So I ask you a question then again. When we think about peace and justice kind of issues in the church, is this liberal or is this conservative? And I think about some of the people who are peace and justice kind of workers. And I think of groups like this bunch of liberals here, working with MDS, Mennonite Disaster Service, after a hurricane hit, I think that was in Mississippi. And what you see there is a bunch of conservative Mennonites, like the name conservative is actually in their name, a bunch of liberal hippies, right? Well, some of them do have beards, I don't know. And I thought about this group here when I was searching for these kind of relief workers. I came up with this picture right here. Yeah, you know those guys? So this guy right here is David, who would be my wife's cousin, who worked with the meat canning truck with MCC. They mentioned it this morning, and his parents happened to be here today. Was not planned, but I put this picture in there whenever it popped up as I was searching relief workers. David worked with three guys, I think, from like Paraguay, is that right? Out of conservative backgrounds. So now we literally from a conservative Mennonite church there in Paraguay. So we start thinking about how we have these messed up paradigms for understanding Jesus. Like, is Jesus liberal? Is he progressive? Is it conservative? Is it traditional? All of these paradigms, these models, they don't work anymore. Do you realize that? Like, Jesus doesn't fit neatly into any of these categories. You know, if we try to take a conservative, traditional reading of the Bible, we're going to take Jesus' teachings seriously. We're not just simply going to write them off and dismiss them, like some of those groups that I mentioned earlier did. We need to take them seriously, engage them, because, like I said, I think Jesus really meant this stuff. We can't simply dismiss it. I came across this image recently. It says, when we say, welcome the stranger, or feed the hungry, or put down your weapon, we're not being leftist or woke. Or I would add, we're not being Marxists or communists. We're quoting Jesus. Jesus simply doesn't fit our established paradigm. And you've heard these things before. You've heard people say, think outside the box, right? And you've heard that. I don't like that phrase anymore. Everybody's saying that phrase, think outside the box. Well, when everybody's talking about thinking outside of the box, that becomes the new paradigm, and that's not thinking outside the box. But we need some better way to understand Jesus, because he doesn't fit into our paradigms. I'm thinking that maybe it's time that we stop trying to fit Jesus into our paradigms, and we try to fit ourselves into what Jesus came proclaiming. I'll give one example here before I close things down. A couple of months ago, I was sitting with a family here from this church, and I asked permission from Danny and Francis so I can tell the story. They didn't know which story I was going to tell, but they're very trusting people, and that's going to come back and get you here shortly. We sat down, we had lunch together at Danny and Francis's house. I believe we had grilled cheese and tomato soup. Sound good? We'll go with that. So we're sitting down with grilled cheese and tomato soup, and it was about the time when the student debt crisis was really like at the forefront of the news. You couldn't turn on the news without hearing about student debt crisis. And we were having this conversation, and we kind of realized that much of what we felt was going on in our government at that time was really just intellectually lazy. Like, it feels like they're only giving us a couple options. Like, if you didn't side with this one group or the other group, like, there was no in-between. Because here there was this group, the Republicans, they wanted to hold these students accountable for all the money that they had borrowed. They said, if you borrowed the money with the expectation that, you know, one day you'd pay it off, well, you must now pay it off. And there were the progressive people who were saying, well, they're never going to be able to pay it off. They can't, you know, raise that much money. They're not going to make that much money. The job market isn't what it used to be. So we should just forgive all student debt. And as we're sitting there, we're kind of going back and forth. We're just like, that's the only two options that are available to us. And I remember as we sat there eating our grilled cheese and tomato soup, we came up with a couple options. A couple options that I think might be, I don't know, better options. We started talking about, well, hey, isn't there an opportunity for the government to not charge interest on student loans? And I started looking this week. You realize that student loans right now, the average student loan, the interest rate is twice what my mortgage interest rate is right now. It would seem pretty easy to me for the government to not charge interest for at least, say, the first 10 years of a loan to help a student pay off their loan, or to just not charge interest at all. And a conservative reading of the Bible might suggest that would be better anyway. Deuteronomy 23:19. You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. And we kept talking about other options, and we talked about these opportunities that some people have to go into underserved communities and the programs that already exist. If a person goes into a certain underserved community as an educator or a medical provider, there are government programs that will help them with their student debt, and they can be forgiven of those debts. If you put a certain number of years teaching at a school where you maybe normally wouldn't have gone to teach, or being a medical practitioner in a community where you normally wouldn't go and you're earning a lower wage. Well, we said, well, can't they just kind of expand those sorts of programs and invite more people to go out into underserved communities to serve those people and in turn be relieved of some of the pressure of their debt? Seemed like a good opportunity to me. So in that hour and a half or so, as Danny and Francis and I sat around the table eating our, or grilled cheese and tomato soup, I feel like we came up with two better solutions than the government had in all of the months before. Not to brag, but we did. No, I just want to show you by this illustration that maybe we can think differently. Maybe we have too frequently fallen into the trap of thinking in these binary categories of left and right, conservative, progressive, Republican, and Democrat, and maybe there's something out there for us that's better. We look at Jesus' teachings today. He didn't simply call people to continue slapping people if they get slapped, or poking an eye out if they get poked out, or knocking out a tooth if they lost their tooth. He says, no, let's think about the problem. Let's get creative. Let's do something different and expose the issue at hand. Let's not be intellectually lazy, but let's do something to actually transform the world instead of just fighting back and forth about these things. So that brings me to my final question. I'm wondering, where are the creative people in our world today? Where are the people who think differently? The people that will call us and invite us into different situations to do things that are not always the way we've done them. I think that unfortunately in the church we have often dismissed these people because they don't fit our normal paradigms. They don't fit in the way we've always done things. These people have not always been welcomed into our churches because they talk differently and they think differently. But I'm just wondering if they're not the very people that we need right now. The people who do think creatively. I keep saying that we are created in the image of a creator God. We are created to be creative people. So where are the musicians? Where are the artists? Where are the creators, the sculptors, the writers? Where are the dreamers in the world right now? Where are the old men who dream dreams and the young men who have vision, or maybe it's the other way around, that the Bible speaks about? These are the people that we need right now. People calling us to do things differently. People calling us to do things afresh. People calling us to do things in the way of Jesus Christ. Well, today we're going to participate in an act that Jesus created. An act of sharing of bread and cup with his brothers around a table. And this act is meant to call us back to remembering who Jesus was. So I want to go ahead and invite Sandy to come forward as she accompanies us, provide some background music. And those that have offered to help serve the communion elements, I want to ask you children to come forward as well. And we're going to participate in the Lord's Supper. So I want the children to do, and because we have higher levels of COVID again,